Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk. With me today are Austin Bay and Jim Dunnigan. Austin is an author, columnist, blogger, and contributor to StrategyPage.com. Jim is a military analyst, consultant for the U.S. military, and well-known author. On Strategy Talk, we discuss current events with our own unique twist. We report news as history.
Welcome, Austin and Jim. Since we talked last time, the dust has settled on the New York bomber, the Times Square bomber there in New York, and we've started making connections, and some of the hopefully some of the politics has settled a little bit too on that, so that we can look at this in a reasonable way. But it looks like there's Pakistan connections there, Jim.
Pakistan connections with terrorism have always been the most dangerous, especially after Iraq, when the Arabs got a taste of Islamic terrorism, you know, when the Al-Qaeda decided that all Arabs are at fault for not coming to their aid in defending Saddam Hussein. That, within a year or two, pretty much greatly deflated, enthusiasm in the Arab world for Islamic terrorism. But that remained in Pakistan. Pakistan is sort of a unique situation. Now, they're getting Islamic terrorism now, and they have actually for the last 5 years, but it's mostly been concentrated in what we call the tribal territories. And the tribal territories are where most of the problems have always been in that part of the world. The problem is 40 million Pashtun tribesmen, or tribals, whatever you want to call them. They have been there for thousands of years, as far as anybody can tell, under one name or another. Alexander the Great ran into them 2,500 years ago. They're Indo-European people, Pashto. The language they speak is related to what we're speaking right now, and more closely related to Iranian or Farsi. They became a problem in the 70s when the military dictatorship of Pakistan has, since it became an independent country in 1947, alternated between elected governments, which were incredibly corrupt, and military dictatorships, which took over because of the corruption. The military, however, could not run the country, and eventually the democracy came back. So that's a cycle that's been going on since 47. The last military dictatorship departed 2 years ago, peaceably, by election. They do all this by negotiation. There's not a lot of bloody civil wars going on up there. But in the 1970s, the military, dictator at the time, decided that, they really do want to clean things up. As corrupt as the place is, there are a lot of good people, both military and civilian politicians, say, we have a mess. We have corruption, we have feudalism, a lot of problems. And they have Islam, which also turned out to be a problem. They decided in the 70s to basically embrace Islamic fundamentalism. In other words, Sharia law. They said religion will save us. The socialism isn't doing it, democracy, maybe a little bit if we could get honest politicians. And so they encourage the use of religious principles and Sharia law throughout the country. They changed the legal system. And then came along the Russian invasion of Afghanistan. That brought in billions of dollars of Saudi money in the form of weapons, cash, for Afghan refugees who are 4 or so million of them poured into Pakistan, and Mujahideen, in other words, Arab holy warriors who are coming to help the Afghans who really didn't need any help. In fact, there's a strange relationship between from that point on between the Arabs and the Pashtun tribesmen, because the Pashtun tribes were doing most of their fighting. They thought the Arabs were kind of effete snobs, rich guys with all the little toys and pretending to be warriors. And that goes a long way towards, explaining some of the odd things that have gone on between the Al-Qaeda, which is mainly an Arab organization, and the Taliban, which, of course, is a homegrown Islamic fundamentalist group. The pro-Islamic people in the Pakistani government were much encouraged by what went on during the 80s. They were getting all this money, a lot of which was stolen, but a lot of it went to where it was supposed to go. And one place where it went was the Saudis also sent missionaries to set up religious schools. Now, this was part of the aid package for the millions of Afghan refugees. And what they would do is they would take young boys, not girls, and give them primarily a religious education. They learned to, read and write Arabic, which did them a lot of good, you know, in Central Asia. But they also inculcated them with the Wahhabi attitude towards Islam and the rest of the world. The Wahhabi attitude is Islam is the best. Non-Muslims are, you know, infidels. If they won't convert, kill them. They're the enemy. Anyway, we've heard this endlessly since 9/11 and even in the 90s. This made the Islamic fundamentalists even stronger. Fast forward to today, you have a situation where most of the country is opposed to Islamic terrorism, Islamic fundamentalism. But about a third of the population is still believes that religion is the path, the only available path to cleaning up the country. Because the country is still a mess. The economy barely functions. The corruption is still rampant. And solutions are being sought. And a big chunk of the population still backs Islamic, you know, fundamentalists. Not all those people, we're talking 50 million people here, back Islamic terrorism. But a lot of them will either look the other way or won't get actively involved in identifying, you know, suspicious activity. Again, because most of the bombings and whatnot are taking place in the tribal territories. Now, the tribal territories is where Al-Qaeda has been hunting out, where the Russians reported just recently their intelligence indicates there are about 40 or 50 terrorist base camps and training areas in the tribal territories, mostly in, and this has been in the news, Waziristan. There's North Waziristan and South Waziristan. The Pakistani army in the last year has finally invaded Waziristan. Now, Waziristan, there are 40 million Pashtuns on both sides of the Afghan border, most of them in Pakistan. 40% of the Afghan population is Pashtun. These are the people who started, who formed the core of Taliban support. So while it seems like a complicated situation over there, it's basically the Pashtuns who really embraced enthusiastically this whole Islamic radicalism routine. They are doing most of the killing. They've always been doing most of the killing. They have been the bad boys of that neighborhood for several thousand years. They can be dealt with, usually through things we can't do anymore, like mass murder. But that's how the Mongols dealt with it. That's how Alexander... He wasn't quite as brutal as the Mongols because he could talk better. But they are intractable. Not all of them. Over the last 100 years or so, a lot of them have basically gotten an education. They've moved into urban areas, gotten decent jobs. Austin has met some of these guys in his time in the military. Quite entertaining, quite knowledgeable about the laws of the hills. But it's the ones, for example, there's about 3 million in Waziristan. A lot of these guys are old school, and they're Islamic fundamentalists, and they will fight to the death. However, they have discovered that they have no way to deal with smart bombs, helicopter gunships, and well-employed artillery, and they are being slaughtered. The kill ratio in the last year has been about 10 to 1. In other words, 10, Pashtuns killed for every Pakistani soldier dying. And the Pakistanis are purposely being very careful with how they use their troops. Even with that, they've lost over 2,000 soldiers in the last year and a half. But as reluctant as the Pakistanis are to deal with this, they realize that more and more of the terrorists that are popping up around the world are either Pakistani, this is what happens in Britain a lot, and happened recently in New York City, or they were trained in Pakistan, mainly in Waziristan, in that strip of unruly tribal areas, perpetually unruly tribal areas, along the Afghan border. This is where Ground Zero is right now. This is the only decent base Al-Qaeda has left. They can go to Somalia, they can go to Yemen, but those two places are the equivalent of desert prison camps because there's no easy way in or out. Pakistan, you can jump in your SUV and drive to an airport in a couple of hours and be on your way. You know, bribe a couple of people at the airport, bingo, you're out of the country. Coming into the country, same thing. The corruption makes it much easier for the terrorists to operate. There's also large Pashtun populations in the big cities. I think there's 2 million in Karachi, which is the largest city. A lot of them are uneducated. The illiteracy rate among the Pashtuns is over 60%. They have the worst jobs, even in the urban areas, most of them. So there, a lot of them are in crime. A lot of them are basically, you know, willing to, you know, take a few rupees, you know, to become a terrorist. So it's basically a perfect environment for terrorists, for Islamic terrorists. And this is why even Obama, well, even before, when he was running for president, he's saying, we got to do something about Pakistan. He was briefed on this, and he's a smart guy. He said, whoa, we got a real problem there. And even though he's got a freshly minted peace prize, he is sending more troops to Pakistan, leaning on the Pakistanis even more. In fact, we reported on this the other day. The American diplomats have been telling the Pakistanis bluntly since the May 1st incident in Times Square that if a bomb traced to Pakistan does go off in the United States, we will send troops into their tribal territories. Now, the Pakistanis have been complaining about us possibly doing that. Actually, we sort of have done it a little bit in the past. But we told them bluntly that we will invade. We'll do it as quietly as possible. But if you can't take these camps out, we will. We know where they are. Hell, even the Russians know where they are with their ramshackle collection of spy satellites they still have running up there. He says it's no secret where they are. In fact, we did a big piece in Strategy Page today about the use of predictive analysis, a new tool. Which we've kept quiet on, but New York Times or somebody, you know, went public with it, so I said, oh, what the hell, now we can talk about it better than
right.
They did. Which has basically enabled us to find a lot of these guys and kill them. So we decimated the Al-Qaeda leadership, but basically you have to send troops on the ground and destroy those camps, keep harrying them. The Pakistanis have done a lot of damage, but basically they don't want to lose a lot of soldiers. It's very unpopular fighting Pashtun tribesmen. I mean, this is nothing new. This goes back centuries. Most of the population, 80% of the population, are lowlanders in Punjab and the Sindh, the two big provinces. And these people traditionally do not send their sons into the hills to fight the Pashtuns. So and this is something that's hard for Americans to understand. Politically, it's very unpopular to send a lot of these lowland boys, although about 25% of the military are Pashtuns. And they were afraid that some of these Pashtuns would have problems with killing other Pashtuns. They found out that not to be the case, especially if they avoided massacring women and children. So they've been very careful, but that means they're very slow, and they can't basically just go sweeping up, you know, the roads and what have you and technically conquer large swaths of land because the bad guys are up in the hills. And so you got to find your targets, which you've been helping them with, and you got to hit them. You got to find out where they are and catch the people who are important, just not, you know, get a big body count. So that's the terrorism problem. It's in Pakistan. It's not easy to get at.
Now, Austin, fortunately, the Obama administration has dodged two possibly major incidences, and we've had another two with the shooting down at Fort Hood, and then there was the shooting at the recruiting station. Were we having the same sort of things happen inside the Bush administration, but we just weren't hearing about them, or have we slacked up a little bit in our watchfulness?
That's a tough call, Dan, because, you know, we don't have access to the current intelligence. It's very, very difficult since you don't have that access, and people who are not immediately involved in defense issues, security response, you don't want the bad guys to know what you know, but unless you got access to it, you really are engaged in rank speculation.
Mm-hmm.
And the worst type of rank speculation is, in my view, having been on the inside and done some of this, is a harsh, harsh judgment. Now, I'll tell you the way that things do appear, and I think I'd be interested in hearing Jim's feedback on this analysis. As you guys know, strategy page readers know, I think we've gone a long way to damaging, I will say defeating, but I mean heavily damaging, the Al-Qaeda that existed and flamed so briefly in September, October, November of 2001. In part, you have to credit the Bush administration with this, with an offensive strategy, saying that a large, complex, multidimensional society like the United States, like really the free world, with its porous borders, and I don't mean porous in the sense of an immigration issue, but we have free flow of travel and trade. You cannot be passive. There's no way to seal it without essential damage, both economic and political, to the system. So the Bush administration says we're going to take a forward strategy, an offensive strategy, a preemptive strategy. And as Jim said, they've lost their Afghan bases. Some of the other places they try to train out of, and their training bases are difficult. And Pakistan is really not an easy place for the larger scale kind and training that Al-Qaeda had prior to the U.S. global offensive to pressurize Al-Qaeda's environment is the way that it's sometimes expressed. So what does Al-Qaeda do? It's had connections with the Taliban and other Islamist groups, Lashkar-e-Taiba, for example, which is the Kashmiri Islamist group. I'll mention some of the other ones, Jamaah-e-Islamiya, which is essentially Al-Qaeda in Southeast Asia. That's Philippines, Indonesia, Malaysia, and the like. They're the ones who committed the Bali atrocity. They've had those connections, but they've been denied that a large base they had when the Taliban ruled Afghanistan. We hammered them in Iraq. I mean, Iraq is a major defeat for Al-Qaeda, both politically, informationally, in terms of also all of the cadres that we've primarily killed, but some captured. So now Al-Qaeda has morphed, and some of it not by choice, but it following, again, more or less a pattern similar to the 19th century anarchists, into a philosophical motivator, looking for individual actors, and I think Major Hassan is a classic example of this, Dan. And I've written this. I think that I know darn well his act at Fort Hood was a terrorist act, but he's philosophically motivated instead of quote-unquote specifically trained for a large-scale operation. Now, I'm not sure about Faisal Shabab, the attempted would-be Times Square terrorist. There's some few squishy things about him. The idea is that he did receive some training in Pakistan. Was this a specific target, or was he to look for a target of opportunity? The Christmas terrorist, also called the panty bomber, and his name has, I've lost his name for the moment, but everyone knows what he tried to do, blow up a plane over Detroit. He was clearly ideologically motivated. He got some training and experience in Yemen, but the first class, well rehearsed, detailed attacks that we witnessed on 9/11. It's not the well rehearsed attack on the Madrid trains. It's certainly not in the same situation, even though I think the Mumbai attack of November 2008 is actually a little bit different category than the ones we're talking about, where they're attacks on the United States or operations in Western Europe, they're in part because of the proximity and also the long conflict between India and Pakistan. And that particular attack, I think, is a slightly different category. But nevertheless, we didn't see that out of the Christmas terrors. So what we're seeing, Dan, are these lower level, I think highly motivated, question of level of training and level of operational direction. I don't know if Major Hassan was told to attack at Fort Hood. It looked to me like a target of opportunity and something that he thought about. But these are the kinds of attacks. They're very, very hard for intelligence and security to stop prior to the act. Jim mentioned a tool that we have in the predictive analysis in the article that's running on strategy page today is really using it in terms of speaking in terms of how you target using Predator as a sensor shooter platform and help bring our attack systems in places where we will likely get a shot at a terrorist. You can use those same techniques for looking at potential. You have to use the word profile here. Profiles, psychological, behavioral profiles of individuals that could become this kind of philosophical, situational terrorist. The police have done this at an intuitive level. I mean, good beat cops do it when they're... Imagine walking through New York, Brooklyn, or Chicago. They know when somebody's aberrant behavior is a clue to a potential problem. Now, on a larger population base, you've got a quantitative difference between that and the beat cop, but you still have some of those tools. I believe they're being applied. At the same time, because of the nature of this dispersed threat of the ideological terrorist, self-motivated, self-starting terrorist. That's why we've seen these occur. I do think that the situation where one person is a U.S. citizen, like the Times Square bomber, he falls into a U.S. citizen category, but the terrorist, the Nigerian who was the Christmas Day would-be, he's an illegal combatant. And I still am very much in favor of military tribunals and treating these terrorists as, that we catch, they're not U.S. citizens, as illegal combatants. The U.S. citizen category, I think, is one that you're going to have to deal with that because the man does have U.S. citizenship. It doesn't mean you can't charge him with an array of absolute of crimes. And do I think that is a deterrent? I think that is the way to handle them properly because you get more of the intelligence asset out of it. And intelligence is, to finally come back to your question, intelligence is what protects us against any kind of terror strike. That's your first line of defense.
Yeah. Now, I'm sure even the current administration, even though they've gotten some flack like that, that they're highly motivated to stop this because they know if one of these even random ones succeeds in a major metropolitan area like New York City, that the political price is going to be very, very steep.
Oh, I completely agree with you. It's not, but I'll say this. I think the Obama administration has caught itself in a number of terribly self-made traps between what was said in the campaign and their political appeal in their primaries and then in the general campaign of 2008 and then the realities of having to see what the deep, complex, dimensions of the terrorist threat and terrorist problem. And in so many ways, despite what he said, President Obama follows a number of things that the Bush administration did. Why? It's because they made sense. There's a whole series of trade-offs that are constantly being made. Those are sometimes they're arbitrary. Oftentimes, it's the lesser of two evils. Yeah, it might be the lesser of 15 evils, to use that phrase. And you have to make tough senior leadership judgments. I don't think the Obama administration's campaign promises or campaign criticisms were warranted when they were made. Now he's got to be president, and he's got to decide how to use the tools of security to defend the American public and defend American interests. Mm-hmm. I think the actions prior were ultimately hypocritical. But I hope that he does continue to, pursue a harder line with the terrorist threat, because it's quite real.
Yeah. Jim, there was an article that you wrote either last week or the week before that really jumped up and smacked me in the face, and that was some of the new tools that Hezbollah has been able to acquire, you know, looking at this as another terrorist front.
Iran apparently feels very pressured, you know, with all the global call for them to, not develop nuclear weapons. And they are apparently trying to equip Hezbollah and Hamas with more powerful weapons so that if Israel does come after them, if the Iranian nuclear weapon, you know, appears, Iran will have more ability to strike back at Israel using Hezbollah and Hamas. And to this end, they have apparently arranged for Syria to transfer longer-range missiles to Hamas. We're talking ballistic and long-range rockets, which can reach about 250 kilometers, carry half a ton warhead. And even if it's just high explosives, you know, they can do a lot of damage because 250 kilometers allows you to basically reach into central Israel where most of the population is. Israel has some anti-missile capability with their Arrow and their Patriot systems. But the story goes that Hezbollah has been given several hundred of these longer-range missiles, which can be carried around in the back of a large truck, you know, stuck into a cave. They're solid fuel. They can be brought out and set up and launched, you know, within 10 minutes. So even if the Israelis have their UAVs all over the area, it's problematic that they're going to spot all of them, and a lot of them are going to be launched. And if they can launch, you know, several dozen, you know, within the space of, you know, 10, 15 minutes, they can overwhelm the Israeli defenses. So the Israeli population is put in real danger. Last year, the Israelis basically updated their civil defense plan and told all the civil defense authorities, which are, you know, throughout the country, that in the event of another war, there would be thousands of casualties, because if the Syrians got involved, and this is, and Hezbollah has been turned into a mini Syria as far as ballistic missiles go, there could be thousands of casualties and, you know, billions of dollars worth of property damage because of the longer range missiles hitting, you know, large urban areas. I don't know what the Iranians feel this will do to the Israelis other than make them angrier. But that is the Iranian plan, and apparently they have carried it out. They have transferred the longer-range missiles to Hezbollah, which is basically a client of Iran, bought and paid for. And they are supplying more missiles, modern missiles, which have to be smuggled into Gaza to Hamas, which is another client of Iran, even though Hamas is Sunni and not Shia. These are missiles that can reach out to maybe up to 40 kilometers and not do as much damage as the ones being given to Hezbollah, but do more damage than the missiles that have been heretofore fired out of Gaza in their thousands, you know, over the last 5 years. So Iran is basically trying to develop a rocket attack force, which will cause the Israelis a lot of pain. But as I say, you know, this is not going to induce the Israelis to surrender. It's just going to make them angrier. And if the Iranians feel that, you know, getting bombed more by not just Israeli aircraft, but by Israeli missiles is going to improve Iran's situation in the world, I don't know. You know, the Iranians may feel that if they're attacked, most of the population in Iran is against the current Iranian government, which is basically a religious dictatorship. And it's always been believed, and many Iranians will tell you this, that if the country is attacked, that the population will rally behind the religious dictatorship. But so what? What are they going to do? If they pop a nuke on Israel, they will get 20 popped on them by the Israelis. So what's the point to all this? Basically, it's a corner the religious zealots in Iran have painted themselves into. Where do they go? They haven't got too many options.
Austin, do you have any thoughts on the...
Yeah, I think one of the things that comes out of this at an operational level, I mean, I think Jim analyzes it great strategically, but operationally, they seed all these shorter-range missiles, and some with significantly improved capabilities to Hezbollah. It gives the Israelis, it puts pressure on Israeli defenses, so that if the Iranians really did go Nazi and decide to shoot a long-ranged ballistic missile with us, special weapon warhead, chemical nuke, what a talk about it. Huge disaster for the entire Middle East if they do, but is that the Israelis would be using their anti-missile missile capabilities on some of these shorter range, and in other words, they've had access kind of a what we used to call in the war games a soak-off attack. Remember that, Jim? That's a soak-off attack, and then they here comes the longer range nuclear system. That's a possibility. I guarantee you, we talk about it here. This was thought about years ago in Israeli Defense Forces headquarters. And I think that's the dimension that should be lost on no one. I will say this, too. I think the Iranians, Hezbollah, as Jim says, is a subsidiary, wholly owned subsidiary of the Khomeiniist regime in Tehran. I think the Khomeiniists would sell those guys out in a second. They see them as the same way as sacrificial forces in their currently shadow war with the Israelis. But they're going to arm their sacrificial forces with as many systems as they can succeed in cramming in to southern Lebanon, and in case of Hamas, put it in Gaza, and, you know, there's some indications that Hezbollah sympathizers have fired a few rounds from the Jordanian desert around Aqaba. That's a report that's come up a few times, because the rockets landed inside Jordan. But
yeah, they tried that a couple of years ago, killed a Jordanian soldier, and they caught a bunch of them, and they executed them.
Yep. Well, then that's really the Jordanian...
But these guys are persistent. They love to do the same thing over and over again. The problem in the Islamic world, and we've done several pieces on this, is that the governments, which are generally, dictatorships or monarchies, have to cover their own deficiencies, which are numerous, have basically created Israel as the core problem. In other words, eliminate Israel and everything will be great. Of course, that's nonsense. They'll still be all inefficient, corrupt dictatorships. But they focus so much of people's hate. We're talking decades of propaganda that Israel's the problem. Israel's the problem. That you have an endless supply of young crazy guys, and there's a lot of young crazy guys who are found everywhere, who are willing to sign up to basically do crazy things, suicide bombing being the craziest, to solve the Israeli problem. And this is the problem, throughout the region. The Iranian mullahs basically ignored Israel for a long time until they found it convenient, to try and, make nice with the Arabs, to say, oh, yeah, we're against the Israelis as well. And now you have Ahmadinejad, the president of Iran, going around saying, you know, oh, there was no Holocaust during World War II. The Israelis are evil incarnate. We will destroy them. Very diplomatic. But this doesn't solve all the problems in the Islamic world. It doesn't solve anything. It just makes them worse. It basically misdirects people's attention, which is exactly what the corrupt rulers want. And it makes it impossible to negotiate any settlement because you have to take care of the Israeli problem. And that means destroying Israel.
Right.
Now, you've got some people in Europe who are saying, well, yeah, okay, why not destroy Israel? If it'll make everything, you know, copacetic and we can all sing Kumbaya together. But, you know, that's fantasy.
Right. Well, it's hopefully something will tamp down the tensions there, and we're not going to get into a shooting war. Although, is there a possibility that Hamas and Hezbollah are going to get the attitude of use it or lose it?
No.
Okay.
No, they basically stay in business by staying in business. You know, let's got to remember, for a lot of people, especially in Hezbollah, which has been around for, you know, over 30 years now, it's a living. That's a job. And job security is basically keeping the game going. Not a fight to the finish. That'll get you killed. I mean, they have pension schemes, you know, all sorts of benefits. You know, a lot of people in Hezbollah, that's their occupation. That's their profession. I'm
wow.
talking thousands and thousands of people. And
wow.
Iran provides the cash. So you don't want it to end. And
right.
if you fight the Israelis, it'll definitely end.
End, right. Well, we've run out of time again, and we'll talk to you gentlemen next time.
Next time.
Bye.
Talk to you later, Dan.